Welcome to Clear Mountains Wednesday evening live stream. We're joined today by one of our deep monastic friends and mentors, Aya Ananda Bodhi. Aya, we're so grateful.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
I may introduce. Aya Ananda Bodhi was born and raised in Wales, UK. Aya first encountered the Buddhist teaching in her early teens while reading about the Four Noble Truths. This was life-changing, and from that moment, she experienced a deep confidence in the Buddha's insight and a wish to understand his teachings more deeply. At the age of 24, Aya began monastic training at Amaravati Buddhist Monastery in England under the guidance of Ajahn Sumedho. 17 years later, she moved to the USA with a wish to create more opportunities for women monastics. In 2011, she took full bhikkhuni ordination, joining the worldwide revival of the Theravada Bhikkhuni Order. Aya Ananda Bodhi loves to share the Dhamma, and her practice is guided by early Buddhist scriptures, living in community, and through nature's pure and immediate Dhamma. And currently, Aya is living in Port Townsend and beginning the Parayana Vihara up there nearby us. Did I get everything, all that right?
Sounds good. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, if we could just jump right in, I wanted to ask what was the first moment you knew you wanted to take robes, and what's kept you in robes all these years?
Well, I remember the first moment very well. So I had come across the Dhamma when I was 14 and looked for Buddhists, but couldn't find, and I found one person actually in my area who wasn't a practicing Buddhist, but was interested in Buddhism. So I used to go and talk to him. He was 70 and I was sort of 14, 15. So we used to talk together about Buddhism, but I didn't know, he didn't meditate. I didn't know how to meditate. And I had, so basically I kind of allowed that real deep interest in Buddhism to go underground. And I just sort of learnt little bits here and there. And then when I was 20, I was kind of going through a bit of a change in my life. And I met this, it was actually the brother of a good friend of mine who'd been in Thailand for a year. And he came back from Thailand and went to visit his friend who was also my neighbor. And he told me, you know, he talked about Ajahn Buddhadasa, going to being on retreat with Ajahn Buddhadasa, and how there were monks in Thailand, you know. And so I was like, really? There are monks, you know, Buddhist monks now? I thought they must have died out hundreds of years ago. But so I, pretty much immediately, I knew within 5 minutes, that's it. That's what I want to do. And then I started telling people, oh, I'm going to become a Buddhist nun. And people, and my friends would say, oh, that's cool, you know. And I imagined I would do it quite a bit later, actually. I kind of wanted to enjoy my life a bit first, to be honest. I thought I would do it in my 30s, but the karma was very strong, so I just sort of got pulled in earlier. So, yes. And also I remember that moment of recognizing this was my path, that it was very... it was just the mind wanting to awaken. There was no, you know, sense of age or gender or race or anything. That was just absent. There was just this, the mind, the heart wanting to awaken.
Thank you, Aya. In your journey through these last decades, you know, you've come from England, you've lived in California, now you're up in Washington. What has kept you in robes through all these years, if you had to kind of point out one thing, a recollection or quality, what's kept you?
Gosh, it's probably impossible to bring it down to one thing. I would say there's many, many things. I mean, I'd say there is a deep resonance for me with the monastic life and with a life that is 100% geared towards awakening. Even if not 100% my time is used in that way, even if I still, you know, sometimes get distracted or, you know, pulled off track, whatever, it's always going in that direction. The momentum is always in the direction of awakening. I think for me, a renunciant life is really helpful and I like it. I'm a greed type by nature, and the renunciant life is it gives a different kind of joy, really. And I'd say that there have been different things over the years. So in the beginning, you know, I certainly gaining insight and a deeper understanding of the Dhamma was a huge reason to stay in the robes. And Yeah, community has been a big reason, a sense of being part of something greater than oneself. You know, it's supportive conditions for practice, and then also being able to share the Dhamma in a way that's where that can, you know, just basically living in attunement with the Dhamma. You know, you wake up in the morning, first thing you say is homage to the Buddha, and chanting. I've always loved chanting. I really like the robes also. I just love wearing the robes. I kind of love everything about it, almost everything, not quite everything. I like it.
Can you say a bit more about sharing the Dhamma and how that's an aspect of your practice and how that's changed over the years? When you mentioned it just now, you included even just when you wake up and saying homage to the Buddha. So what is sharing the Dhamma to you, and how does it support and how has it changed your relationship to this?
I suppose in a way for me, there's always been a sharing. You know, I started in Amravati, which is quite a big community, monastic community. And part of being there is that you serve, you know, you give a lot, you spend a lot of your time working and serving the community. So that's one way. And in the last, I mean, basically since I've been in the US, really, I did a little bit of teaching before then, but not much in the UK. But in the US, it was sort of a requirement to being here. So at first I found that quite stressful, a bit frightening, and I didn't feel very confident, and I sort of hoped I would be able to get away with not doing very much. And then over time I realized, oh, I actually really like it. You know, it's a lovely thing to do, because when teaching, when sharing the Dhamma verbally, first of all, I learn a lot doing that, and it benefits people in the best way. You know, there are so many ways one can benefit others, and to benefit others by sharing the Dhamma just feels like a sort of, it's kind of a gift in itself for me, you know, to be able to do that. But I think also, you know, living in community, having been connected, whether one's got a lot of people around, whether you're with lots of people or not, just having a sense of sharing, listening, you know, giving pointers to people, receiving teaching, all of that, it creates a field. It kind of creates this field of deepening understanding, and it weakens the strong narrative in this country of materialism. You know, it's like a different narrative that's being shared. So all of that.
Part of that field, which I've found, specifically your teachings, which are unique, one of them is a gratitude body scan. Could you say more about that? I think it's a really beautiful concept, which I just never heard from anyone else.
Yeah, I guess I got that from a poster, actually, a Qigong poster that had an image of a body, and it would have, I think it was something like smile into the liver, smile into the heart. It was sort of a graphic image of the body, and then it had these lovely little messages on each of the organs. And I was, oh yeah, that's a lovely thing to do. And personally, you know, it took me a while to really befriend this body, you know, to come into the body. So when I first started to practice, it was, you know, it wasn't a very embodied experience. It was actually very lovely, often quite blissful in those early years, but not very embodied. And coming into the body, for me, there was quite a lot of trauma. So there could be meditation that was just really beautiful that wasn't very embodied, but then coming into the body was not a pleasant experience. So once I finally started to do that, and I used the breath originally to come into the body more, to gently into the embodied experience, there was a lot to clear out. And I realized that the relationship between mind and body was not a mutual, not a friendly relationship. So the mind had assumed this greater importance and superiority over the body, and sort of put up with the body, you know. And then at some point the body kind of said, hey, you know, I'm working really hard for you every day. You know, I'm very loyal and faithful to you, and you don't respect me, you know. And so there was this sort of dialogue really between the body and mind, where the mind got a little humbled, and the body got a little bit more say. So I think it's a common thing that is a common misunderstanding, actually, that the mind is superior, is a superior teacher than the body. The body is a profound teacher. It's all here. The body is part of nature. It comes from nature. It is nature. It returns to nature. It's deeply attuned to the way of things, to the Dhamma, actually. And then it gets mistreated often. So I've learned to really appreciate, and I recognize that the body likes attention. It likes to be appreciated. And so I do that myself, and I encourage others to.
Thank you, Aya. And I know you're planning on giving a 5-day retreat on the body with Ajahn Kobilo this autumn.
Yes, coming up next month.
And so if you had to give advice to others who have not found a way to befriend their body, who feel alienated or just averse to it, what other techniques would you recommend or other approaches that would let someone make that relationship more gentle?
Mm. Well, there are several things. I think the first thing I want to say is there is a Gestalt practice that I was taught years and years ago, which actually initiated that conversation between body and mind. And I have taught this to several people. I'm not sure how well it'll come across without showing you, but anyway, I'm going to try. And it was taught to me by a seminara many years ago in Chittist, who had been trained in as a Gestalt therapist before he was in the monastic life. And he had all of us doing it who wanted to try it out. And basically what we did is we had some paper, we didn't do it on laptops or iPhones, we had paper and pen, say maybe 4 or 6 sheets of paper or so, and 2 seats opposite each other, so 2 zafus or 2 chairs, just 2 things similar. And we sit in one chair opposite the other chair, or sit in one zafu opposite the other zafu. And the first seat is the seat of mind, and this seat is the seat of body. So you sit in the seat of mind, and you opposite body, and you write a letter, dear body. You write a letter to see just what does the mind want to say to body. It might take, give it plenty of time, maybe 15 minutes, whatever. Dear body, da, 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 and you just see what the mind wants to say, and then signed mind. And then you put the letter on the seat of body, and then you have to get up and physically move to the body seat. Then you sit on the body seat, you open that letter as body, you read it, and the body writes back, dear mind, da, 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 da. Whatever it wants to say, give it plenty of time. Hands the letter back to mind, and then you go back to mind seat. You have to actually physically move between the seats. Go back into the seat of mind, and then you read that letter from body as mind. It's interesting. It's very insightful. So that for me was a real turning point, actually, doing that exercise, where I realized there was a sort of slave and master relationship between the body and the mind, which was not a relationship I wanted to continue. So I often encourage people to do that, actually, as an initial exploration to see what is going on here. Because otherwise we tend to be up here thinking we know what's going on, but you actually need to hear from the body too. So that would be a big shift to do that. And then there are just things like just being considerate about what you put into the body, about, bathing and exercising and if for people who've had a lot of trauma, sometimes there's no sense of the edges of the body. Sometimes you just sort of left the body. And so to feel the edges of your body, if that's the case for you. So you get to know where it begins and ends.
I am curious, I'd never heard that Gestalt method of practice, of inquiry. And I'm curious, you've been in robes for a long time now. How long is it?
Papaja, 30 years. This will be my 30th Vasa since going forth. And then I was a couple of years before.
Sadhu. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in robes and practicing for 30 years. And I'm curious if you could speak at all to just depth of practice and breadth of practice. I mean, mentioning, you know, practicing with Gestalt and, you know, gratitude body, and you and I have talked about our mutual interest in this having no head practice of mm-hmm. Richard Lange. And I think some people, when they think of monastic life or what that would be like, they just think, oh, it's going to be a life of a Goenka retreat or basically just doing one method for the next however many decades. And that's not people in our condition, in our traditions experience, but would love how you balance those two.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was trained in Amravati and Chittas, and Amravati, Ajahn Sumedho, he is really interested in what helps you to wake up. So quite a lot of his teaching isn't, you know, classical Theravada, and he encouraged exploration as long as it was within reason. I mean, not a huge amount, but he encouraged exploration as long as it was leading in the right direction. And when I first came to the monastery, I was very much I just want Theravada Buddhism. I don't want to hear about anything else. I just want Theravada Buddhism. And somehow circumstances were such that other things sort of came in and worked in ways that were unexpected, all sorts of things actually. I think the first thing was when I was at Anagarika reading a book by another Anagarika. Said, you must read this book. I didn't read a lot in those days, but I just, okay, you know. And I started reading this book called Hidden Journey by Andrew Harvey, which is about Mother Meera, a sort of holy Indian woman who lives in Germany, and not at all the direction I wanted to go in. And then I started having dreams that were teaching me, you know, things that I really needed to see, like about my own conceit and stuff like this. And so it was like, oh, this book is sort of waking something up on a level that somehow the monastic life wasn't really showing me. So, I'm very much a sort of a devotional type, and sometimes, so practices of devotion have been very, very fruitful for me. So, I mean, and also, I mean, it's 30 years, there's a lot of time to cover, but, you know, in the early years, my meditation was very deep and very bright and quite blissful. So I enjoyed meditation immensely. And it was sort of like I had a magnet, you know, to the meditation cushion or the walking meditation path. And so that was great, you know, and that was fruitful for early years. And then I went through a period of time where it was much more dry and more difficult and less, you know, less juicy, let's say. And part of that was this coming more into the body. That wasn't an easy time necessarily. I mean, it was not that bad, but it wasn't, I didn't get the same sort of blissful experiences that I had before. But it was also clear that was needed. It was a maturing. So, and also then devotional practices. So when I lived in Chittas with Ajahn Sucitto, he did a lot of devotional practices. We were building a stupa there, and there was just lots and lots of circumambulations and chanting barefoot in all weathers. And that for me was wonderful. My mind went into absolute presence doing that. And, you know, that was great for me. So there was something about giving of myself, you know, that surrendering that was very fruitful and beneficial. But then also the nuns community, you know, we were a small community of women who were from all sorts of backgrounds, very, very different characters from different ages, different classes, different nationalities. In a small group, in a large group of monks. And, you know, we were always sort of a little bit off on the side. And around the time that I was coming in, there was a recognition that the Sila Dharas we were needed some help from outside. You know, just trying to figure it all out from in there was too difficult. It wasn't really working, and we needed a bit of extra support or an outside pair of eyes, let's say. And we ended up with all agreeing on working with this woman who was she primarily did Hellinger family constellation work, which is something that's probably too difficult for me to explain right now. She was also trained in Gestalt, and she was also had a spiritual practice, not Buddhist. So she was a very skilled and wise and grounded, and she would come, I think it was maybe two weekends a year, sometimes three, and work with the sisters. And we'd come from both communities together to work on that. And everybody, it was voluntary, but everybody came. So I learned about, it's hard to kind of speak about it, but you kind of really get to see from very different perspectives doing that work. So, you know, here we are in our own perspective and how we think it should be and what's going on. And then you get to experience from a very different perspective the same situation, and it can be very helpful in undoing some stuck patterns. And we also, for a shorter time, were invited to the Karuna Institute in Devon, which is a Buddhist-based psychotherapy training center, and they train in core process psychotherapy. And so the theory, the basic premise is, at the core of one's being is a process. There is no core. And the two founders had both been Buddhist monastics in the past, and one in the Theravada tradition, one in Tibetan tradition. And they were a married couple at that time, and they established this center. So they taught us also about trauma, how trauma is in nature, not just in humans, but how it happens in nature, how in nature, you know, there'll be a herd of gazelle or whatever grazing, and then the lion will come along and start chasing them and go for the slowest and the weakest one. And then if that animal is caught, sometimes it'll faint before it's actually killed, and the lion will only eat what it kills. So it doesn't want to eat it, but it's, you know, maybe it'll maul it around a little bit, and then when the gazelle or the deer or whatever it is comes around, if the lion's away and it comes around, it shakes. It'll shake and shake and shake and shake. It'll just lie there shaking. And as long as it's not interrupted during that shaking, then it'll be able to just get up, go and join the herd, and it'll be just no trauma. It's fine. And they're all alert. You know, they're all looking out for trouble. They're not just, you know, sleepy. But they're not traumatized because of that shaking. The body shakes it out. So we learned about trauma and about how that gets stuck, and did some work also with the people there. So it's been a whole lot of different things, actually, different elements. Yeah, and I really appreciate that piece of the work, the trauma work, because so many people have trauma, you know, and it's helpful to understand how to meet it in a way that can transform.
Thank you, Aya. And in terms of the navigating trauma or facing difficult circumstance and coming away with gratitude and not letting it kind of leave a scar, these past 30 years have been full of, you know, a lot of different tumult, from your movement to California to recently Aloka Vihara, you know, nearly burning and then dissolving. And how have you kept your heart bright and touched with gratitude through that? How would you advise others to encounter hardship, or is there anything that's been particularly sustaining for you?
Yeah, I mean, coming to the US was kind of fun, actually. It wasn't such a hardship. And the ending of the Vihara was just clear. I mean, it took me a while to really come into attunement with it, but it became clear that it was the right thing to do. I would say one thing that's really important is to is to have a reality check, because there's how things. I'm very idealistic by nature, you know, and I want things to be great and wonderful, and, you know, and life is life. So one thing that's really, really helpful is knowing what one wants it to be, feels it should be, wishes it was, and then knowing how it is. And then finding a way of coming into balance, those two coming into balance, you know, because life doesn't work out the way we think it should. It's not the way we think it should. And there are some things that are harder than others, you know, I think probably different things for different people. Yeah, dealing with hardship. I mean, there are so many different kinds of hardship, isn't it? So, I mean, material hardship is one thing, and then I think the biggest hardship for me would be it would be relational. So I think, I kind of hesitate to get into the whole thing, but I think the really hard thing was more realizing the extent of and depth and solidity of the patriarchy in monasticism. I sort of fooled myself for a long time that it wasn't really like I thought it like it was, but at some point it just became so clear that there was no way that I could, anymore fool myself in that way. And because I wanted it to be better than that, and I wanted it to be more inclusive and less identified, honestly, with gender and so on. But it wasn't. So for me, that was the very big hurdle, the really big knock in my monastic life was where I really wondered, I really had some doubts about the whole thing. And then I felt that it was getting this very, very clear, very strong message from the monks in the monastery in England that, the nun's position would be, in that context, would be perpetually subordinate and never have opportunities for leadership and shouldn't be used as a stepping stone for full ordination. It's kind of such a tiny little, we were given such a tiny little space to move, let's say, that I realized that wasn't, I couldn't do that. And I'd given my life energy to that for years, and so that was a big shock, actually, to realize that there was no future in that for me in that context.
Thank you, Ivor, for sharing that. And if you had to frame this moment since Alokavihara's dissolution, and maybe, in terms of the West Coast and bhikkhunis here or elsewhere, how would you frame this for people?
Frame it.
Or how would you speak about what's because on one level you could say Alokavihara, dissolved and there's a way of looking at that where it's only a loss, but it actually seems like there's a great deal of good happening right now.
Well, Alokavihara Forest Monastery was a dream, it was a dream of a forest monastery, and because I'd had a wonderful experience in forest monasteries in the UK, and I guess my heart's wish was to recreate that so other people could also benefit the way I had benefited in the past without the, without the patriarchal context being so prominent. And it wasn't something that we could recreate. We weren't able to do that. And we had 8 years in the forest monastery. And over time, what became clear was, we were getting older and people weren't coming to join us. And every year it was getting hotter and drier, and we were basically waiting for the fire. We sort of saw it coming about. We were a couple of years before it actually happened, we were, ready to evacuate and so on. So it was kind of okay, the climate isn't good. It's not adding up. And I was probably one of the last people to admit it, actually, because I really wanted it to work and I still had ideas and and it wasn't that all the ingredients went right to make that happen. So again, it's this thing of how one would wish it to be and how it is. And coming into alignment with how it is, it's like, okay, it's not actually a, it's becoming a hostile environment, it's so hot. And it also raised the question for me. I mean, I know that there are forest monasteries in California, but in that particular context where it's very, very dry and very hot in the summers, spring and summer, is it actually appropriate anymore? Is it felt it's not right because the fire department, if there's a fire, they will protect people first and then property second and then environment. And having little meditation huts in the forest is just kind of a nightmare for the fire department, So in that environment, it just was clear, it was that coming into attunement with how it is rather than how I wished it was. So it ended with, we've now become like a, I think this is what you're pointing to, a seed pod that is, so like a hard thing was a seed pod that just popped after the fire. Oh, he disappeared. And can you hear me still?
We can still hear you.
Good. Yeah. And there you go. And hi. And there are now four places from that one place, which is very nice. So from the people who were there. So there's Parayana Vihara here in Port Townsend. There's Pasadi Vihara in Olympia. I just visited the bhikkhunis there a few days ago. There's Canmore Theravada Buddhist Monastery up in Canmore, Alberta. And then there's the Aloka Earth Room in San Rafael, California. So all of the bhikkhunis stayed as bhikkhunis and started, you know, gathering inside new places. And so I kind of trust the organic nature of it, actually.
Thank you, Aya. So we'll open it up to questions if anyone has a question they'd like to ask. And in the meantime, would you be willing to just say, on the level of how things are right now, just what's going on with Parayana Vihara? What is Parayana Vihara?
Mm-hmm. So Parayana Vihara is predominantly a place for monastic, female monastics to live. It's a rented house, a three-bedroom rented house on a quiet street in Port Townsend, near everything, but very quiet. So it's a nice location. And we have, on Sundays, we're open for people to come, bring a meal. Some Sundays it's a meal, shared meal. And from 1:30 till 3:30, there's time for meditation together and Dhamma. I have a Dhamma reflection, and we have some discussion. And so it's more of a place to gather on the Sunday. And I don't have any great plans, actually. So, you know, the Aloka Vihara Forest Monastery, I had a lot of plans about what I wanted it to be, what I thought it would be, and it wasn't that. It didn't work out. So this time I'm trying a different way. I'll just let it see what wants to arise.
Thank you, Aya. And on that note of merging reality with what you would like it to be, I remember you taught me the phrase, here's another cold, hard one coming straight at you from reality, something like that.
Did you teach you that?
Well, I heard it when I was there. Like that. I think I might have gotten it a bit wrong, though. But one thing also, and people should feel free to put questions in the chat, but would you be able to speak to a teacher you've had or two that you've encountered that have really moved you? And are there any particular experiences or qualities that made that the case?
Yeah, I have been very blessed with amazing teachers in this life. And obviously Ajahn Sumedho was my teacher for many years in Amravati. And what I can say about him was he's the most generous person I've ever met in my life. Amazingly generous in many, many ways. So that was life-changing, really, having a place to go and Dhamma kind of offered so generously, and requisites and a lot of allowance for the fallibility of a human being, of all of us, a lot of room for learning. So that was and also Ajahn Sumedho's meditation practice and the sound of silence I've also found very, very beneficial. And I guess the other two people I'd like to mention are Mechi Putumwan, who is a Thai Mechi who lives in southern Thailand. And she used to come over during the Vassa for a few years. And we just had a very sweet connection. And she taught me a lot, actually. Many in a very loving and playful way. And I think there's many things, but I think maybe the connection was a really important piece, but also this teaching she gave. Let's see if I can do this. She one time, because she spoke Thai and not much English, I spoke English very almost no Thai, so sometimes we had a translator, sometimes not. But she taught me this very beautiful teaching, which was, the hand was like this, but I'm going to do it like this. Atta anatta. And that was really important. I often reflect on that. Atta anatta. It's the same hand. It's just everything's the same. It's just this grasping. There's no grasping. And then I added, the five aggregates, the five khandhas. So that's self and no self. You know, there it all is. Grasping the five aggregates, not grasping. They're still there, not grasping. So that's really important. And then the other very important teacher who really just touched my heart so deeply was Venerable Maha Gosananda, Cambodian monk. who's passed away now. He was I think he was the supreme patriarch of Cambodia. And we always thought that was kind of funny that he was a supreme patriarch, because there was nothing patriarchal about him at all. Mm. He was a very beautiful, pure being. It's very highly realized. I don't know, you know, it takes one to know one, so I don't know how highly, but definitely no greed, no hatred. Purely responding from compassion and humor and wisdom and clarity and love. So my interactions with him, I met him three times, were profound and life-changing. Yeah, in different ways, each time in a different way.
Wow, thank you so much. Lompo Samedo Mechi, Patomwan, and Mahagosananda. People should look those people up. And unfortunately, Mahagosananda has passed away. But I'm not sure if Mechi Patomwan is still giving teachings, but...
I think she's teaching in Thai only. Yeah.
Okay. We have questions that are stacking up. This first one, dear Aya, it's wonderful to have you here in Washington State. Okay. Heart sentiment. Yeah.
I love being in Washington State.
Great. We love you being in Washington State. Would the Venerable speak on grief? My companion had passed away. The master too is gone. There is no companionship now that equals this mindfulness directed to the body. This is from the Theragata, quoted by Ananda. Could you speak?
Yes. This is a very important question, actually, about grief, because thank you, Joseph. In the Buddha's teaching, you know, it's clear that grief is something that can be. One can be free of feeling grief. And there's that story of the Sangha gathered around the Buddha at the end of his life, after he passed away, actually, in Kushinaga. And only the arahants the arahants were serene, and everyone else was crying and wailing. And, you know, the devas were all wailing, and the people were all crying, and the arahants were serene. And I used to sort of misunderstand that in some way until I went there, actually, when I was there in Kushinagar, having gone on pilgrimage and then ending up at the place where, you know, really getting a sort of visceral sense of the Buddha and living and teaching and sharing the Dharma and waking people up and helping people to wake up. And then he passed away. I realized you'd kind of have to be an arahant. You'd have to be enlightened to not grieve, you know, because it's such a... It even arises in me just thinking about it. It's such a great loss, you know, to lose such a beautiful being as the Buddha. So I think sometimes we can read the suttas and we see that the arahants didn't grieve, and then we think we should be like that, you know, grieving's wrong. But until one has got to the place where one understands that deeply, not just intellectually, but knowingly, deeply, grief is a useful way, and I keep coming back to the same thing. Grief is a way of coming from how we want it to be to how it is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people are familiar with lock systems in canals. I guess in the UK I see them. A lock system is you're going along in your barge on the canal, and then there's a hill. So there's a lock system, so the canal stops here, it goes down. And so you have to go into this lock here where the water is gradually lowered. And then once it's lowered, your boat is down where the canal is again. So it's kind of like that. And I think of it, you know, we're going along here and it's how things are. And then we lose somebody or something tragic happens. And then all of that water has to come out, you know. All that water has to come out until we can get to back down there. This is how it is now. And if we try to override that by some idea, it kind of makes us a little unwell. So I think grief has its place. And if we're really present with grief and we know that it's a process, it's passing through, it's not who and what I am, but it needs to arise now. And it's also, grief has its own, it's like, it can be like, it's a bit like waves. So you get a wave of grief and suddenly there it is, it's really strong. And then it passes and you feel fine. Then it comes again. And so learning how to just be with that, just to be the knowing of that and not to judge it or, you know, judge oneself or think you shouldn't have it or whatever, but to know it and what it feels like and what's needed. And it helps us to come into acceptance, really, of how things are.
I thank you for that lock metaphor. That's I've never heard that before. Yeah. Dave has a question. Aya, you have referred to equanimity as the bird's eye view. That's great. Would you elaborate? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I got that actually from a friend who's a Sanskrit scholar, who she pointed out that in, you know, a translation of upeka in upeksha in Sanskrit is bird's eye view, which is such a lovely, I just found that as such a lovely image rather than equanimity, which is a, rather an odd word that you only really hear in Buddhist circles. I don't know if people talk about it outside of Buddhist circles. And nobody, you know, equanimity can give the idea of everything's got to be even all the time. But upeka, so actually upeka, kind of just tying into the previous question, you know, there can be upeka with grief. So grief appears to be, you know, very emotional, and but there can be, if you take the bird's eye view, then there's like, oh yeah, of course, there's been this big loss of something or someone that was meaningful to me. That's a big part of my life, and so it's bumpy, you know. So it's hard. So I'm going through this, and then this tumult, and then the bird's eye view, the upeka view, understands that. It's got room for that. It's not tracking every up and down. It's like, oh yeah, there's that up and down going on, and it's just going through its process, and it's going to change. It's okay. It belongs. So the bird's eye view is like that. And I like to think of the pelicans. I love those pelicans. If you ever watch pelicans, if you get a chance by the sea, by the ocean, they sort of, to me anyway, they embody upeka. They're just so chill. You know? they've been around for millions of years. They've just got it down, and they just don't waste any extra energy, but they all work together, and they, I don't know, they're just amazing. So to me, pelicans are a beautiful symbol of upeka. Not, they don't get into a flap.
That's beautiful. Yeah, one of the Buddha's 80 minor marks is that he moves like a swan. So somewhat related. Beautiful. We've got a cool question here. Aya, what is are your favorite formal practices right now?
Yeah, metta is always one of my favorites. So in the radiant style, so in the way the Buddha teaches of spreading in all directions for the benefit of all beings. All four Brahmaviharas, actually. And then sati, you know, mindfulness and noticing when it's present, when it's not, when it's less present, when it's not present. Bringing sati to what is happening here, you know, reactions to things and how I'm impacted by things, and you know, sort of, it's just very much here. I like to dedicate in the morning my practice for the benefit of all beings. I feel that's very important. It's just not just about me getting somewhere. And exploring what gets in the way of freedom. I guess that's kind of what I'm looking at the moment. What gets in the way of freedom here?
Thank you so much, Aya. All the nautical analogies make me glad that you're on the ocean now. And you moved to the Pacific Northwest about a year ago at this point, maybe a bit more. And we're just so grateful to have you nearby as a guide and a sister and a friend. Thank you.
Thank you. I so appreciate you both too, very much.
Yeah. Well, if people want to join, we'll actually have more time to talk to Aya because she's going to join us on Zoom. So I'm posting the link into the chat. If you can't see it there, then go to clearmountainmonastery.org. And halfway down the page, you'll see a link to our Wednesday evening Zooms. And we should have a chance to talk a bit more there. But until we get you on the live stream again, Aya, or see you in person, just we're very grateful to have you nearby.
Thank you, Vantes.